Vimes hated and despised the privileges of rank, but they had this to be said for them. At least they meant you could hate and despise them in comfort. Willikins would arrive at an inn an hour before Vimes's coach, and, with an arrogance that Vimes would never dare employ, take over several rooms and install Vimes's own cook in the kitchen. Vimes complained about this to Inigo. "But you see, Your Grace, you're not here as an individual, but as Ankh Morpork. When people look at you, they see the city."
"They do? Shall I stop washing?"
"That is very droll, sir. But you see, sir, you and the city are one. If you are insulted, Ankh Morpork is insulted. If you befriend, Ankh Morpork befriends."
"Really? What happens when I go to the lavatory?"
"That's up to you, sir." At breakfast next morning, Vimes sliced the top off a boiled egg, thinking, "This is Ankh Morpork slicing the top off a boiled egg. If I cut my toast into soldiers, we're probably at war." Corporal Littlebottom entered carefully and saluted.
"Your message came back, sir," she said, handing him a scrap of paper. "From Sergeant Strong in the Arm. I've deciphered it for you. The scone from the museum's been found, sir."
"Well, that's the other shoe dropped," said Vimes. "I was worried there for a moment."
In fact, Constable Shue is bothered about it," said Cheery. "It's a bit hard to follow what he says, but he seems to think someone made a copy of it."
"What?
A fake of a fake? What good's that?"
"I really couldn't say, sir. Your other surmise was correct."
Vimes glanced at the paper.
"Ha! Thanks, Cheery. We'll be down shortly."
"You're humming, Sam," said Sybil, after a while. "That means something awful is going to happen to somebody."
"Wonderful thing, technology," said Vimes, buttering a slice of toast. "I can see it as its uses.
And when you grin in that shiny sort of way, it means someone's playing silly buggers and doesn't know you've just thrown a six."
"I don't know what you mean, dear. It's probably the country air agreeing with me."
Lady Sybil put down her teacup.
"Sam?"
"Yes, dear?"
"This is probably not the best time to mention it, but you know I told you I went to see old Mrs. Content. Well, she says—"
There was another knock at the door. Lady Sybil sighed. This time it was Inigo who entered.
"And we should be leaving, Your Grace, if you don't mind. I would like us to be at Slake by lunchtime and through the pass at Willingness before dark."
"Do we have to rush so?" sighed Sybil.
"The pass is slightly dangerous," said Inigo. "Somewhat lawless."
"Only somewhat," said Vimes.
"I will just feel happier when it is behind us," said Inigo. "It would be a good idea if the second coach follows us closely and your men stay alert, Your Grace."
"They teach you tactics in Lord Vetinari's political office, do they, Inigo?" said Vimes.
"Just common sense, sir."
"Why don't we wait until tomorrow before attempting the pass?"
"With respect, Your Grace, I suggest not. For one thing, the weather is worsening, and I'm sure we are being watched. We must demonstrate that there is no yellow in the Ankh Morpork flag."
"There is," said Vimes. "It's on the owl and the collars of the Ibos."
"I mean," said Inigo, "that the colours of Ankh Morpork do not run."
"Only since we got the new dyes," said Vimes.
"Yeah, all right, I know what you mean.
But look, I'm not risking the servants if there's any danger, and there's to be no arguing, understand? They can stay here and take the mail coach tomorrow. No one attacks the mail coaches any more."
"I suggest Lady Sybil remains here too, sir."
"Absolutely not," said Sybil. "I wouldn't hear of it. If it's not too dangerous for Sam, it's not too dangerous for me."
"I wouldn't argue with her if I was you," said Vimes to Inigo. "I really wouldn't."
The wolf was not very happy about being tethered to a tree, but, as Gaspard said, never trust nobody. They'd paused a while in a wood about 5 miles from the town. It'd be a brief stop, Carrot had said. Some of the people in the square looked the sort who treasured their lack of a sense of humour. After some barking and growling, Gaspard said,
"You've got to understand that mate here is personally known gratis in local wolf society, being a bit of a lone wolf."
"Yes?" Carrot was taking the roast chickens out of their sack.
Gaspode's eyes fixed on them. "But he hears the howling at night."
"Ah, wolves communicate."
"Basically, your wolf howl is just another way of pissing against a tree to say it's your damn tree. But there's always a bit of news, too. Something nasty's happening in Oberwald. He doesn't know what."
Gaspode lowered his voice. "Between you and me, our friend here was well behind the door when the brains was handed out. If wolves was people, he'd be like foul old Ron."
"What's his name?" said Carrot thoughtfully.
Gaspode gave Carrot a look. Cared what a wolf was called.
"Wolf names is difficult," he said. "More like a description, see? It's not like calling yourself Mr. Snuggles or Bonzo, you understand?"
"Yes, I know, so what is his name?"
"You want to know what his name is, then?"
"Yes, Gaspode."
"So, in fact, it's the name of this wolf you want to know."
"That is correct."
Gaspode shifted uneasily.
"Arsehole," he said.
"Oh."
To the dog's frank astonishment, Carrot blushed.
"That's basically a summary, but it's a pretty good translation," he said. "I wouldn't have mentioned it, but you did ask."
Gaspode stopped and whined for a moment, trying to convey the message that he was losing his voice due to lack of chicken.
There's been a lot on the howl about Angua," he went on, when Carrot seemed unable to take the hint. "They think she's bad news."
"Why, she's travelling as a wolf, after all."
"Wolves hate werewolves."
"What? That can't be right. When she's wolf-shaped, she's just like a wolf."
"So? When she's human-shaped, she's just like a human. And what's that got to do with anything? Humans don't like werewolves. Wolves don't like werewolves. People don't like wolves that can think like people, and people don't like people who can act like wolves. Which just shows you that people are the same everywhere," said Gaspode.
He assessed this sentence and added,
"Even when they're wolves."
"I never thought of it like that."
"And she smells wrong. Wolves are very sensitive to that sort of thing."
"Tell me more about the howl."
"Oh, it's like the clacky thing. News gets spread for hundreds of miles."
"Do the howls mention her companion?"
"Nah. If you like, I'll ask Ars—"
"I'd prefer a different name if it's all the same to you," said Carrot. "Words like that aren't clever."
Gaspode rolled his eyes.
"There's nothing wrong with the word amongst us pedestically gifted species," he said. "We're very smell-oriented."
He sighed.
"How about bum? In the sense of, migratory worker. He's a freelance chicken throttler style of thing."
He turned to the wolf and spoke in canine.
"Now then, bum, this human is insane, and believe me, I know a mad human when I see one. He's frothing at the mouth inside, and he'll rip your hide off and nail it to a tree if you aren't straight with us, understand?"
"What was that you're telling him?" said Carrot.
"Just explain him we're friends," said Gaspode.
To the cowering wolf he barked,
"Okay, he's probably going to do that anyway, but I can talk to him, so your only chance is to tell us everything."
"No, nothing," the wolf whined. "She was with a big he-wolf from Oberwald, from the clan that smells like this."
Gaspode sniffed.
"He's a long way from home, then. He's a bad news wolf." "Tell it there'll be roast chicken for its trouble," said Carrot.
Gaspode sighed. It was a hard life being an interpreter.
"All right," he growled. "I'll persuade him to untie you. It'll take some doing, mark you. If he offers you a chicken, don't take it, because it'll be poisoned. Humans, eh?"
Carrot watched the wolf flee.
"Odd," he said. "You'd have thought it'd be hungry, wouldn't you?"
Gaspode looked up from the roast chicken.
"Wolves, eh?" he said indistinctly.
That night, when they heard the wolves howling in the distant mountains, Gaspode picked up one solitary, lonely howl behind them. The towers followed them up into the mountains, although, Vimes noticed, there were some differences in construction. Down on the plains they were more or less just a high wooden gantry with a shed at the bottom, but here, although the design was the same, it was clearly temporary. Next to it, men were at work on a heavy stone base. Fortifications, he realised, which meant that he really was beyond the law. Of course, technically he'd been beyond his law since leaving Ankh-Morpork, but law was where you could make it stick, and these days a city watch badge could at least earn respect, if not actual cooperation, everywhere on the plains. Up here,
It was just an ugly brooch. Slake turned out to be a stone-walled coaching inn and not much else. It had, Vimes noticed, very heavy shutters on the windows. It also had what he thought was a strange iron griddle over the fireplace, until he recognised it for what it was, a sort of portcullis that could block off the chimney. This place expected to withstand the occasional siege that might include enemies who could fly. It was sleeting when they went out to the coaches.
"Storm's closing in," said Inigo. "We'll have to hurry."
"Why?" said Sybil.
"The pass will probably be closed for several days, your ladyship. If we wait, we may even miss the coronation. And there may be slight bandit activity."
"Slight bandit activity?" said Vimes.
"Yes, sir."
"You mean they wake up and decide to go back to bed? Or they just steal enough for a cup of coffee?"
"Very droll, sir. They do notoriously take hostages."
"Bandits don't frighten me," said Sybil.
"If I may," Inigo began.
"Mr. Skimmer," said Lady Sybil, drawing herself up to her full width, "I did, in fact, just tell you what we are going to do. See to it, please. There are servants in the consulate, aren't there?"
"There is one, I believe."
"Then we shall happily make shift as best we can, won't we, Sam?"
"Certainly, dear."
It was seriously snowing by the time they left, in great feather lumps, which fell with a faint damp hiss, muffling all other sound. Vimes wouldn't have known that they'd reached the pass if the coaches hadn't stopped.
"The coach with your men on it should go in front," said Inigo, as they stood in the snow beside the steaming horses. "We should follow close behind. I'll ride with our driver, just in case."
"So that if we're attacked by anyone, you can give them a potted summary of the political situation," said Vimes. "No, you will ride inside with Lady Sybil, and I'll ride on the box. Got to protect the civilians, eh?"
"Your Grace, I—"
"But your suggestion is much appreciated," Vimes went on. "You get inside, Mr. Skimmer."
The man opened his mouth. Vimes raised an eyebrow.
"Very well, Your Grace, but it is extremely—"
"Good man.
I should like my leather case down from the roof, though."
"Certainly. A bit of fact-finding will take your mind off things."
Vimes walked forward to the other carriage, poked his head inside and said, "We're going to be ambushed, lads."
"That's interesting," said Detritus.
He grunted slightly as he wound the windlass of his crossbow.
"Oh," said Cheery. "I don't think they'll try and kill us," Vimes went on.
"Does that mean we don't try to kill them?"
"Use your own judgment."
Detritus sighted along a thick bundle of arrows. They were his idea. Since his giant crossbow was capable of sending an iron bolt through the gates of a city under siege, he had felt it was rather a waste to use it on just one person. So he'd adapted it to fire a sheaf of several dozen arrows all at once. The threads holding them together were supposed to snap under acceleration. They did so. Quite often the arrows also shattered in mid-air as they failed to withstand the enormous pressure. He called it the Peacemaker. He'd only tried it once, down at the Butts. Vimes had seen a target vanish. So had the targets on either side of it, the earth bank behind it, and a spiralling cloud of feathers floating down had been all that remained of a couple of seagulls who had been in the wrong place at the wrong time. In this instance, the wrong place had been directly above Detritus. Now no other watchman would go on patrol with the troll unless they could stay at least 100 yards directly behind him. But the test had the desired effect, because someone saw everything in Ankh-Morpork, and news about the targets had got around. Now, just the knowledge that Detritus was on his way cleared a street much faster than any weapon.
"I got lots of judgment," he said.
"You be careful with that thing," said Vimes. "You could hurt someone."
The party started out again through the swirls of snow. Vimes made himself comfortable amongst the luggage, lit a cigar, and then, when he was sure that the rattling of the coach would mask the sounds, rummaged further under the tarpaulin and drew out Inigo's cheap, scarred leather case. From his pocket he took a small roll of black cloth and unrolled it on his knee. Intricate little lock-picks glinted for a moment in the light of the coach lamps. A good copper has to be able to think like a criminal. Vimes was a very good copper. He was also a very alive copper, and intended to remain that way. That was why, when the case's lock went
Click! He laid it down on the shaking roof with its lid opening away from him, and, leaning back, carefully lifted the lid with his boot. A long blade flicked out. It would have terminally ruined the digestion of a casual thief. Someone obviously expected very bad hotel security on this journey. Vimes carefully eased it back into its spring-loaded sheath, looked upon the contents of the case, smiled in a not very happy way, and carefully lifted out something that gleamed with the silvery light of carefully designed, beautifully engineered, and very compact evil. He thought, sometimes it would be nice to be wrong about people. Gaspode knew they were in the high foothills now. Places to buy food were getting scarce. However carefully Carrot knocked at the door of some isolated farmstead, he'd end up having to talk to people who were hiding under the bed. People here were not used to the idea of muscular men with swords who were actually anxious to buy things. In the end, it generally worked out quicker to walk in, go through the contents of the pantry and leave some money on the table for when the people came up out of the cellar. It had been 2 days since the last cottage, and there had been so little there that Carrot, to Gaspode's disgust, had just left some money. The forest thickened. Alder became pine. There were snow showers every night. The stars were pinpoints of frost. And, colder and harder, rising with the sunset, was the howl. It went up on every side, a great mournful ululation across the freezing forests.
"They're so close I can smell 'em," said Gaspode. "They've been shadowing us for days."
"There has never been an authenticated case of an unprovoked wolf attacking an adult human being," said Carrot.
They were both huddling under his cloak. After a while, Gaspode said,
"And that's good, is it?"
"What do you mean?"
"Well, of course, us dogs only has little brains, but it seems to me that what you just said was pretty much the same as saying no unprovoking adult human being has ever returned to tell the tale, right? I mean, your wolf has just got to make sure they kill people in quiet places where no one will ever know, yes?"
More snow settled on the cloak. It was large and heavy, and a relic of many a long night in the Ankh-Morpork rain. In front of it, a fire flickered and hissed.
"I wish you hadn't said that, Gaspode."
These were big, serious flakes of snow. Winter was moving fast down the mountains.
"You wish I hadn't said it. But, no, I'm sure there's nothing to be afraid of."
A drift had nearly covered the cloak.
"You shouldn't have traded the horse for those snowshoes back at the last place," said Gaspode. "The poor thing was done in. Anyway, it wasn't exactly a trade. The people wouldn't come down out of the chimney. They did say to take anything we wanted."
"They said to take everything, only spare their lives."
"Yes, I don't know why I smiled at them."
There was a doggy sigh.
"Trouble is, see, you could carry me on the horse, but this is deep snow, and I'm a little doggy. My problems are closer to the ground. I hope I don't have to draw you a picture. I've got some spare clothes in my pack. I might be able to make you a coat." "A coat wouldn't do the trick."
Another howl began, quite close this time. The snow was falling a lot faster. The hissing of the fire turned to a sizzle. Then it went out. Gaspode was not good at snow. It was not a precipitation he normally had to face. In the city there was always somewhere warm if he knew where to look. Anyway, snow only stayed snow for an hour or two, then it became brown slush and was trodden into the general slurry of the streets. Streets. Gaspode really missed streets. He could be wise on streets. Out here he was dumb on mud.
"Fire's gone out," he said.
There was no answer from Carrot.
"Fire's gone out," I said.
This time there was a snore.
"Hey, you can't go to sleep," Gaspode whined. "Not now, we'll freeze to death."
The next voice in the howl seemed only a few trees away. Gaspode thought he could see dark shapes in the endless curtain of snow.
"If we're lucky," he mumbled.
He licked Carrot's face, a move that usually resulted in the lickee chasing Gaspode down the street with a broom. There was merely another snore. Gaspode's mind raced. Of course, he was a dog, and dogs and wolves, well, they were the same, right? Everyone knew that.
"So," said a treacherous inner voice, Maybe it wasn't exactly Gaspode and Carrot in trouble. Maybe it was only Carrot.
"Yeah, right on, brothers. Let us join together in wild runs in the moonlight. But first, let us eat this monkey."
On the other paw. He'd got hard pad, soft pad, a swinge, licky end, scroff, mange, and something rather strange on the back of his neck that he couldn't quite reach. Gaspode somehow couldn't imagine the wolves saying, "Hey, he's one of us." Besides, while he'd begged, fought, tricked and stolen, he'd never actually been a bad dog. You needed to be a moderately good theological disputant to accept this, especially since a fair number of sausages and prime cuts had disappeared from butcher's slabs in a blur of grey and a lingering odour of lavatory carpet. But nevertheless, Gaspode was clear in his own mind that he'd never crossed the boundary from merely being a naughty boy. He'd never bitten a hand that fed him. After all, this made it so much harder for the hand to feed you tomorrow. He'd never done it on the carpet. He'd never shirked a duty. It was a bugger, but there you were. It was a dog thing. He whined when the ring of dark shapes closed in. Eyes gleamed. He whined again and then growled as unseen fanged death surrounded him. This was clearly impressing no one, not even Gaspode. He wagged his tail nervously.
"Just passing through," he said in a strangulatedly cheerful voice. "No trouble to anyone."
There was a definite feeling that the shadows beyond the snowflakes were getting more crowded.
"So, have you had your holidays yet?" he squeaked.
This also did not appear to be well received.
Well, this was it then. Famous last stand. Plucky dog defends his master. What a good dog. Shame there'd be no one left to tell anyone.
He barked, "Mine, mine!" and leapt snarling towards the nearest shape. A huge paw swatted him out of the air and then pinned him down, spread-eagled in the snow. He looked up, past white fangs and a long muzzle, into eyes that seemed familiar.
"Mine!" growled the wolf.
It was anger. The coaches slowed to a walk on a road that was rough with potholes under the unbroken snow, every one a wheel-breaking trap in the dark. Vimes nodded to himself when he saw lights flickering beside the road a few miles into the pass. On either side, old landslides had formed banks of scree, down which the forests had spilled. He dropped quietly off the back of the coach and vanished into the shadows. The leading coach stopped at a log which had been dropped across the road. There was some movement, and then the driver swung himself down into the mud and set off at a dead run back down the pass. Figures moved out of the trees. One of them stopped at the door of the first coach and tried the handle. For a moment, the world held its breath. The figures must have sensed it, because the man was already leaping aside when there was a click, and the whole door and its surrounding frame blew outwards in a cloud of splinters. The thing about fires, Vimes had once observed, was that only an idiot got between them and a troll holding a 2,000-pound crossbow. All hell hadn't been let loose. It was merely detritus. But from a few feet away, you couldn't tell the difference. Another figure reached for the door of the second coach just before Vimes fired out of the darkness and hit his shoulder with a butcher's sound. Then Inigo dived out through the window, rolled with un-clerk-like grace as he hit the ground, rose in front of one of the bandits, and brought his hand around edge-first on the man's neck. Vimes had seen this trick before. Usually, it just made people angry. Occasionally, it managed an incapacitating blow. He'd never seen it remove a head.
"Everybody stop!"
Sibyl was pushed out of the coach. Behind her, a man stepped out. He was holding a crossbow.
"Your Grace, Vimes!" he shouted.
The word bounced back and forth between the cliffs.
"I know you're here, Your Grace, Vimes, and here is your lady. And there are many of us. Come out, Your Grace, Vimes!"
Flakes of snow hissed over the fires. There was a whisper in the air, followed by a second smack of steel into muscle. One of the hooded figures collapsed into the mud, clutching at his leg. Inigo got slowly to his feet. The man holding the crossbow appeared not to notice.
"It is like chess, Your Grace, Vimes. We have disarmed the troll and the dwarf, and I have the queen. And if you shoot at me, can you be sure I won't have time to fire?"
Firelight glowed on the twisted trees bordering the road. Several seconds passed. Then the sound of Vimes's crossbow landing in the circle of light was very loud.
"Well done, Your Grace, Vimes, and now yourself, if you please."
Inigo made out the shape that appeared at the very edge of the light, with both hands up.
"Are you all right, Sybil?" said Vimes.
"A bit cold, Sam."
"You're not hurt?"
"No, Sam."
"Keep your hands where I can see them, Your Grace, Vimes."
"And are you going to promise me you'll let her go?" said Vimes. A flame flickered near Vimes's face, a bright pool in the darkness, as he lit a cigar.
"Now, Your Grace, Vimes, why ever should I do that? But I'm sure Ankh-Morpork will pay a lot for you."
"Ah, I thought so," said Vimes. He shook the match out, and the cigar end glowed for a moment.
"Sybil?"
"Yes, Sam?"
"Duck."
There was a second filled only with the indrawing of breath, and then, as Lady Sybil dived forward, Vimes's hand came around from behind him in an arc. There was a silken sound, and the man's head was flung back. Inigo leapt and caught the man's crossbow as it was dropped, then rolled and came up firing. Another figure staggered. Vimes was aware of a commotion elsewhere as he grabbed Sybil and helped her back into the coach. Inigo had vanished, but a scream in the dark didn't sound like anyone Vimes knew. And then, only the hiss of snow in the fire.
"I think they're gone, sir," said Cheery's voice.
"Not as fast as us. Detritus?"
"Sir."
"Are you okay?"
"Feeling very tactful, sir."
"You two, take that coach. I'll take this, and let's get the hell out of here, shall we?"
"Where's Mr. Skimmer?" said Sybil.
There was another scream from the woods.
"Forget him."
"But he's..."
"Forget him."
The snow was falling thicker as they climbed the pass. The deep snow dragged at the wheels, and all Vimes could see were the darker shapes of the horses against the whiteness. Then the clouds parted briefly, and he wished they hadn't, because here they revealed that the darkness on the left of him was no longer rock, but a sheer drop. At the top of the pass, the lights of an inn glowed out onto the thickening snow. Vimes drove the carriage into the yard.
"Detritus?"
"Sir."
"I'll watch our backs. Make sure this place is okay, will you?"
"Yes, sir."
The troll jumped down, slotting a fresh bundle of arrows into the peacemaker. Vimes spotted his intention just in time.
"Just knock, sergeant."
"Right you are, sir."
The troll knocked and entered. The buzz of sound from inside suddenly ceased. Vimes heard, muffled by the door,
"The Duke of Ankh-Morpork is coming in. Anyone have a problem with this? Just say the word."
And in the background, the little humming, singing noise the peacemaker made under tension. Vimes helped Sybil down from the coach.
"How do you feel now?" he said.
She smiled faintly.
"I think this dress will have to go for dusters," she said.
She smiled a little more when she saw his expression.
"I knew you'd come up with something, Sam. You go all slow and cold, and that means something really dreadful's going to happen. I wasn't frightened."
"Really? I was scared stiff, said Vimes.
"What happened to Mr. Skimmer? I remember him rummaging in his case and cursing."
"I expect Inigo Skimmer is alive and well," said Vimes grimly, "which is more than can be said for those around him."
There was silence in the main room of the inn. A man and a woman, presumably the landlord and his wife, were standing flat against the back of the bar. The dozen or so other occupants lined the walls, hands in the air. Beer dribbled from a couple of spilled mugs.
"Everything normal and peaceful," said Detritus, turning round.
Vimes realised that everyone was staring at him. He looked down. His shirt was torn, mud and blood caked his clothes. Melted snow dripped off him. In his right hand, unregarded, he was still holding the crossbow.
"Bit of trouble on the road," he said. You know how it is."
No one moved.
"Oh, good God, Detritus, put that damn thing down, will you?"
"Right, sir."
The troll lowered his crossbow. Two dozen people all began to breathe again. Then the skinny woman stepped around him from behind the bar, nodded at Vimes, carefully took Lady Sybil's hand from his, and pointed towards the wide wooden stairs. The black look she gave Vimes puzzled him. Only then did he realise that Lady Sybil was shaking. Tears were running down her face.
"And, my wife is a bit shaken up," he said weakly. "Corporal Littlebottom," he yelled to cover his confusion.
Cheery stepped through the doorway.
Go with Lady Sib—"
He stopped because of the rising hubbub. One or two people pointed. Someone laughed. Cheery stopped, looking down.
"What's up?" Vimes hissed.
It's me, sir. Ankh-Morpork pork dwarf fashions haven't really caught on here, sir," said Cheery.
"The skirt," said Vimes.
"Yes, sir."
Vimes looked around at the faces. They seemed more shocked than angry, although he spotted a couple of dwarfs in one corner who were definitely unhappy.
"Go with Lady Sybil," he repeated.
"It might not be a very good idea," Cheery began.
"Gods damn it!"
shouted Vimes, unable to stop himself. The crowd went silent. A ragged, blood-stained madman holding a crossbow can command a rapt audience. Then he shuddered. What he wanted now was a bed. But what he wanted before bed, more than anything, was a drink. And he couldn't have one. He'd learned that long ago. One drink was one too many.
"All right, tell me," he said.
"All dwarfs are men, sir," said Cheery. "I mean, traditionally. That's how everyone thinks of it up here."
"Well, stand outside the door, or shut your eyes or something, okay?"
Vimes lifted Lady Sybil's chin.
"Are you all right, dear?" he said. "Sorry to let you down, Sam," she whispered. "It was just so awful."
Vimes, designed by nature to be one of those men unable to kiss their own wives in public, patted her helplessly on the shoulder. She thought she'd let him down. It was unbearable.
"You just... I mean, Cheery will, and I'll sort things out and be along right away," he said. "We'll get a good bedroom, I suspect."
She nodded, still looking down.
"And I'm just going out for some fresh air."
¶¶